there are a lot of things that assume that they're going to get a sine wave as the power supply, and when it's decidedly not a sine wave, it generates a lot of random noise in the circuitry and obscures a lot of function.
Well, digital devices do prefer a nice, a nice clean wave. I don't use an inverter, but what I do use is I use a line conditioner for all my radio equipment, and it's called the Trip Lite, TRIPPLITE LC2400. It's a line conditioner, handles several amps. You can look it up on the spec sheet. And it has removed just a whole bunch of just line noise from my AC in my shack in the house. And I recommend it.
Oh, okay. You know, like I said before, these things are not kind of binary usually. They're just attenuators. So it depends upon the amount of distortion and the sensitivity of the final device you're using. If you're going to use an audio device that's not really doing a lot of heavy filtering of its power, you're going to get a mess. And, you know, even if you put it through a line conditioner, it's just inherently, some of that stuff is just garbage. You know, if it's just a matter of stuff leaking into it, then the Trip Lite would be sufficient. So it's one of those things that you can, you know, probably best to buy it from some place that you could return it if it's not enough.
Oh, absolutely. I think Amazon has it on their website for one of the other models. I have the 2400, and, you know, it worked really, really well for me. The other possibility, and it's a very expensive possibility, is using, but this is not really an inverter. It would be a power, you know, like a line isolator, you know, but I don't think that's what you're looking at.
No, a line isolator wouldn't really help you. That's just getting you, floating your ground, you know, to something like a transformer that with a one-to-one winding and such. You have to somehow do a lot of filtering on the curve or, you know, something along those lines. Because, again, you know, just look up. I'm sure there's loads of Google images of an oscilloscope of AC coming out of something like a generator. You know, inexpensive power generators are infamous for really dirty outputs because it's cheaper that way.
Well, you could use a UPS if it's really, really high quality and it produces a, I think that's, what's the name of it again? Oh, God. It's not the vendor. It's the type, I forget right now. But it's a type of UPS that will go ahead and produce a close to a regular sine wave.
Yeah, the more expensive UPSs have much more sophisticated inverters that reproduce utility alternating current. But that's just kind of reinventing the wheel. You know, if you already have a power storage device, that's just a kind of UPS in a slightly different form. So you probably end up just being easier to buy a higher quality energy storage device that has its own built-in electronics that reproduces a much lower noise, better sine wave reproduction for the load.
KG2RY.
Yes, David?
Good evening. I was inquiring about some kind of AC filter for my radios. It's like a 4 or 5 port. It has a ground pin. It's ground pin enabled. And how to say? They sell them on DX Engineering.
Okay, what are they called?
I'm not sure. I'm still looking for it. Power strip with AC filter. Yeah, it's just a pretty simple thing, but, you know, the DX Engineering endorsed that product.
Yeah, but it's not for that purpose. It's a simple spike filter, so that if for some reason you have some electronic equipment that feeds the spikes into the utility line, it will improve that condition. It's not designed to take a completely noisy, corrupted, non-sine wave output and you know, reintegrate it into a perfect utility sine wave load. Voltage and currents and such. So, it might be something very useful, but for a different purpose and a different price point. You know, if something, you know, those devices, you know, can easily go for about $40-$50. But, you know, in order to the difference between a UPS that gives you a clean alternating current sine wave versus a dirty one could be, you know, $400-$500 difference. So, you could buy a $50 thing from DX Engineering and save yourself $500. Everyone would do it, but it doesn't work that way.
QSL. Yeah, it seems to work for me okay, so I don't complain for that. Whether I can tell the specific difference in the quality of the signal, you know, that's still questionable. But I didn't want to spend like $300-$400 for it. I don't know if the signal coming out of my AC is dirty, as you say.
Well, it depends. I mean, these are primarily problems with inverters. So UPSs and large energy storage devices for the home, those are the things that can either be done well with some money or cheaply and not so well. That's the primary problem at hand here. There's a lot of things that kind of inject a little bit of noise and stuff, and that's a lot easier to deal with than an inherent, intrinsically non-sine wave electrical power output. Those things require significant measures to attenuate them.
Yeah, but like, what if you took a linear power supply into your radio? Would there be much difference between a linear power supply into your radio and a modern switching power supply?
Ultimately, it depends on who you ask that question to. If it's a very high-quality switching power supply and it has sufficient filtration to filter out the higher frequencies, the signal should be perfectly fine. I use switching power supplies. I have for many years, and I don't have any horror stories. Inevitably, if you ask too many guys, you'll come across guys who give you horror stories of how they plugged it into an oscilloscope and were aghast at the distortions that they saw coming out of the power supply. It depends upon the quality of the switching power supply. It's a little bit, technologically speaking, it's easier to get it right with a linear power supply than a switching power supply, but it can be done, and you can end up with a switching power supply that's just as good for less money and more efficient and lighter weight. And that's why my power supplies for many years have been switching power supplies. I have one wall wart that's actually a linear wall wart. It's about three times as heavy as any of my other wall warts. I bought it simply to do some experiments with the different technologies and didn't really find anything significant.
I was in the market for a linear power supply, and I looked and I realized that they probably would not fit on my desk. I just don't have space for one of those. You know, I have an Elenco 32 ampere power supply, and it has a knob on it which allows you, if there is noise and somehow generated from the power supply, you could change the frequency of the noise.
Yeah, I have that one as well. It changes the high frequency setting, so that if you're not getting, if it's not filtering completely and it's bleeding into your radio, by turning the knob, you offset the high frequency that the switching power supply is operating at.
Yes, sir. And does it have anything to do with how close in proximity the power supply is to the radio?
It really shouldn't. It's a function of the actual power supply itself. It shouldn't really be that much that it's bleeding over, because it should be properly shielded against RF from the switching circuitries inside the power supply. So it's just the fact that the output isn't being properly filtered. So it's by offsetting the frequency, you're moving the noise to a portion of the RF spectrum that your receiver is going to be less sensitive with, and you won't be bothered by it.
Well, if you have noise at a specific frequency, you know, and you are also having QSO with some person, or you want to call them, you know, or let's say, you know, KCRC 10 meter net, you know, and there's a noise exactly on that frequency from the power supply, you know, you can move that noise off of the frequency.
Yeah, if that's the problem. If the problem is it's not the original frequency of the switching power supply, it's the multiple harmonic, because the switching power supply's native frequency is in kilocycles, not megacycles. So if you just happen by bad luck and poor filtering to have landed on an area of the band that's a harmonic multiple of the switching power supply's primary frequency, then twirling that knob will offset it to the, you know, up or down, and get it off the area where you're listening to.
QSL. Well, I never used that knob, but I thought, you know, would have thought it's interesting. You know, there's some kind of noise there, some kind of some RF that is either intermediate frequency or some other thing, and to be able to move it up or down.
Yeah, well, but it's only if it's from the switching power supply is the problem. Otherwise, adjusting the offset knob is not going to do anything. And I have that particular power supply, and I played around with it, and I never noticed any difference. So presently, my main power supply is about twice the capacity that Alinco is, and it doesn't have an offset to adjust the switching frequency, and I've never felt the need.
QSL, do you know about the Jetstream power supply?
Not offhand. I assume it's another Chinese brand. You know, again, it depends upon you know, the quality assurance. Some Chinese stuff is very, very nice. You know, I mean, iPhones are made in China. But there are other companies where your quality assurance is problematic. So it sort of depends upon the manufacturer and what year you bought it in. You know, sometimes manufacturers kind of get a little lazy, or they get a little hyper, or, you know, something changes. So it's not only the brand, but it's the year that counts.
Comment.
Yes, Brian.
Samlex makes a very good power supply, and they have several models, SAMLEX. You might want to look into that.
Yeah, mine is a Tenma.
Yours is a Tenma? Where is that made?
Nebraska, I think it was Nebraska, there was a factory for Fender guitars, and made the Stratocaster, and that year, with Stratocasters, worth $25,000 today, each guitar, you know, for some reason, that was a really good year.
Okay, well, I mean, good years kind of amount to different things. Sometimes it's just marketing, sometimes it's technology, but you're never quite sure. But, yeah, I mean, there are, you know, like anything, just like wine, especially, you know, artistic type of, creative type of things, there are people who kind of are looking not only for a specific model, but a specific manufacturer.
He's doing All-Star. All-Star can be a little problematic.
Oh, okay. KF2ZZ for station ID. Yeah, I think he said he was using a... I wanted to ask him again what model power supply he was using, the company name.
He's using the one same as me, the Alinco 32 ampere switching power supply.
I thought he mentioned another name, Ken something.
Wait till he comes back.
No worries. That's
yeah, I'm back. I'm back. Well, you know, if I had to be thrown off All-Star, at least it was towards the end of the net.
Roy, what is the name of the power supply that you use? Did you say Ken something?
Tango M-A.
10-A?
10-M-A.
Tenma. Where is that made?
I assume it's a Chinese manufacturer. But again, I've had it for about 12, 13 years, and, you know, it never gave me a day's trouble.
It's switching, right?
Yeah, all my power supplies, except for one wall wart, is a switching power supply.
Okay, thanks.
No problem.
I'm looking at Astron.
Astron is a very good brand for both switching and linear power supplies. You know, they tend to be built like tanks.
QSL, that's what I hear. I also hear that they're like 80 pounds.
Well, those are the linear amplifiers. They also, I believe, have brands of switching power supplies. Those are relatively much lighter.
Also, price went up since I last looked. But, you know, I'll tell you, the Alinco and the Jetstream, you know, they work pretty good. I don't complain, and no problems so far. And the Alinco is connected to the HF, and the Jetstream is connected to the 2 meter 440.
Okay, whatever works for you. I've heard of Jetstream. I never owned one, but I haven't heard anyone really say anything nasty about it, so... It sounds like a decent power supply. There's not really that much to finesse about power supplies. You know, the design concepts are kind of ancient at this point, so it's just a matter of the manufacturer, you know, using good parts and having their employees put it together right.
Last question.
I got it from... The recommendation comes from a person that I trust. I guess the idea is you know, you can have two radios on at the same time and listen at the same time.
Yeah, you can listen to as many radios as you want to listen to. You really, it becomes problematic if you want to transmit on some and receive on some others. I mean, like I said, I have my Tenma, and it's connected to all my radios and connected to part of the branch with the UHF and VHF is hooked up to one of those Epic PowerRite devices that feed battery and the power supply. If the power supply dies, it goes on battery supply. So it's all on one, though, switching power supply, my Tenma. I think it has something like 60 amps in it.
Question.
I divide 32 in one radio, 30 in another radio, and, you know, I can listen to, standby on a 2-meter 440, or I could listen standby on HF. I could listen to them at the same time.
Yeah, I have two VHF radios receiving simultaneously on different antennas. It's doable. Brian, you wanted to say something or ask a question or something?
Quick question. On linear amplifiers, don't they use a linear power supply, or do they use, in some cases, switching on the low-end ones?
Yeah, they could use switching. A linear amplifier is not dependent upon the nature of its power. It just means that it's an amplifier that's operating in a linear fashion as opposed to a nonlinear fashion. But I mean, a linear power supply has practically nothing to do with a linear amplifier, except that they use the term linear, both of them. So it's independent. There's a lot of linear amplifiers that have built-in switching power supplies in them.
Okay, good to know. I just wanted to go ahead and clarify that.
Sure, no problem. Well, it's 10:26 plus, and I thank everyone who participated tonight. I hope some of you learned some things, and I hope you had a fun time, and hope you join us again next Sunday night when we try and do this all over again. But this is a good time to bring on Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet Report.
Thanks, sir.
You're welcome.
Okay, very good, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. I have two power supplies, both switching. The old Radio Shack one radio that I'm transmitting on now, and I use the Samlex for the HF rig, which I really like. That's got 2 meters attached to it, one for amperage and one for voltage. So I'm listening to this whole power supply story. I'm very happy with both of them. Okay. On the ISS coming up, it's actually January 8th, so very shortly they're going to have the first of two spacewalks. And the idea is to add another solar array, roll-out solar array to the complex. And you're going to have the two astronauts going to go out. Mike Finn, an experienced spacewalker. This will be his 10th spacewalk over all these years. And then Zena Cardman, that'll be her first spacewalk. She's actually the commander on the spacecraft that they came up with on the Falcon 9. She's got a crew of four. But this will be the first spacewalk, and we'll see how they do it. They'll do the initial setup, and then there'll be another spacewalk, which will eventually actually install the rollout solar array. And these things are massive. You know, each solar ray is like 40 feet by 200 feet. And it's four gigantic sets they produce. And I think they're getting close to 200 watt power system. It was dropping off to around 180, I think they said 160. The ones that were put on many decades ago, the thing's been flying since, 2000. And all the solar arrays came, soon after that. But eventually they lose efficiency. And their initial 180 kilowatt systems probably dropped down to 160. But now they're adding these other ones over the last, 7 or 8 years. They've put quite a few. ROSA systems that roll out solar arrays, and this will be just another one. It goes in front of the old one, but it doesn't take up the whole space of the old one. About 2/3 of the area, but it's new technology. These things won't deteriorate like the old ones. And per square foot, a lot more bang for the dollar compared to the old ones. Well, we'll see. I know I've talked about the solar array system and the batteries on board space station many, many times. So I'm not going to go over that again, but, you need power. And as the years went on, they actually needed more power because, they actually have a 7-person crew, where originally it was designed for, for 6. The amount of science equipment that they have on board, 300 to 400 different science experiments going at one time, these things all eat up electricity. But to get an idea of these things, collectively, if they were sitting on Earth, could power up around 40 or 50 houses. So you're getting a lot of juice out of the sun. This is WS2N. That's before we move on. Starlink system is they're up to almost 10,000 different satellites in space now, which is quite a few. When I first heard about this, they said, "Oh, they'll need 4,000 satellites." And then out of 10,000, now a lot of them fail. They just stop working. When they do, they have ion thrusters on board, and they can actually deorbit them, let them burn up in the atmosphere. But sometimes they just don't work. When they are initially send them up there, they just won't use the ion thrusters to push it into a higher elevation, which is the ultimate goal. So they'll just let them get eaten up by the atmosphere. The atmosphere will eventually slow it down, and they'll burn them up if they weren't working. But one of them just went up, a couple of weeks ago, and apparently something must have went wrong because there's now debris involved with this. NORAD is actually able to trace it. They can trace anything that's, roughly 10 centimeters. About 4 inches. It's 4 inches or longer. They'll be able to track all these things over the years. But this particular Starlink apparently spoke up to some degree. Turns out there's another constellation of satellites that are up there that are dedicated to taking pictures, and the company that controls them got within around 120 miles of this satellite, and they took a picture. It was a nice picture. I mean, you could see the solar panel sticking out. Amazing the quality of the picture that came back from another satellite. And it showed it looks like it's intact, but they know it's not because they do see debris when they're tracking it. So apparently it's not in a higher elevation like I said before, and they believe within a few weeks this thing should deorbit. So I don't know, over the years I've heard a lot of problems with the Starlink broadband satellites. I'm just wondering if Amazon is going to have the same problem with their LEO satellites. When I say they have around 180 of them up so far, eventually they plan on full operation, 3,200. They'll be putting up 20 more this year. So I'm wondering if Amazon is going to have that same type of problem with these things where, you know, some of them fail. All of them that they have sent up so far are working perfectly, they say. So maybe Amazon will be better off in the future. You know, for two reasons. You know, less satellites. The astronomy people really don't like this whole deal there. Where you're putting up 10,000, and Elon Musk wants to put up now, I read 40,000. I don't know how he could be allowed to do that, but that's the ultimate plan. And for the short term, for the next year or two, out of the almost 10,000 satellites that are up there, he's going to start lowering half of them to a lower altitude. And he's going to do that to try to avoid the possibility of a runaway effect where a couple of these things hit one another or another satellite. You're going to have, you know, catastrophic cascading effect, which would, you know, they really want to avoid that. Now, the bad news there is that they'll be at a lower altitude, which means if the atmosphere expands more than they expect, which happens all the time because of the sun, they could have a situation where they could start losing more satellites, which means they'll probably want to set up more satellites. The Amazon system, they now call it LEO, they used to call it Kuiper. The new LEO satellites are originally planned to actually fly at a much higher altitude than what Elon Musk is doing. So overall, they won't have, they shouldn't have this kind of a problem. But you never know. Comments, WS2X.
Brian, KF2ZZ. Paul, did they ever isolate that leak that was in the compartment and plug it?
Did they isolate that leak that you said? The one that was in the module on the Russian side?
Correct.
Yeah, all they do is monitor it. They actually officially can't. This has been going on quite a few years now. And the Russians said at one point, oh, they patched it as some kind of stuff that they used on the inside. You know, they didn't go outside. They did it from the inside. They thought, you know, oh, this is it. But apparently it wasn't. You know, it keeps leaking. And, you know, they know the pressure. You know, when they close both doors, you know, the progress vehicle docked to this one port. So they put the door on the Progress, and they closed the door on the Zvezda Russian side. So now you have what they call a vestibule in between, where the leak is. It could be coming maybe from, a seal. That's what I think. This thing has got a seal on the whole circumference where it's docked to it. It might be there, or it might be an actual crack in the vestibule itself. Officially, they don't know, so they keep losing around. They said 2 pounds of air per week. It doesn't sound like much, but it adds up. And 90% of the air that's on board is all recycled. And some flights that go up, they bring up extra big gigantic bottles of breathable air that is normally used for the station, because nobody's going to lose something. You do a spacewalk, like I mentioned before, they'll be leaving the quest module. That's where they have the spacesuits, and every time they do a spacewalk, they vent off some amount of air before they go out. In the Quest lab, there's two rooms. One room where they get dressed and, put themselves together, and then the two EVA astronauts go into the next part of the module in Quest. They close off that seal. It looks like a big garage door when they close it. And there's a window there. The guys on the inside can see what they're doing on the outside. And then they open up. Well, then at that point they pump down the air. It's 14.7 pounds. It's the same pressure we have here on Earth. They pump that down, and there's always some residual air in that. Left in there, and they open up the door on it. They'll lose a little here, a little there, and they do need to replace that. But if you start losing, instead of 2 pounds, 4 pounds or something, it just gets worse. That would be totally unacceptable. And they need that port. There's 8 ports on the International Space Station. There's 4 on the American, European space side, and then on the Russian side, there's 4. And, I think about a month ago, all of them were occupied. Unfortunately, the one that's leaking is the one that's attached to the Zvezda module for the Russian side. That's the module that they use that has thrusters on that, and every now and then they refuel the thrust, gas it up with some of the Progress missions that come up. They fill it up, and when a Progress ship is not there, they could fire those thrusters to move the International Space Station. They definitely need that port available. Years ago, they used to also be able to dock a crew to that. Now they won't dock a crew to that because of this leak. So they will only dock with cargo vehicles. Any time the Progress or the crew vehicle was attached to any one of the ports, you know, the system was just to leave both doors open, both hatches open. But ever since this leak developed, they don't do that anymore. I just don't understand why they can't find that leak. They cannot confirm exactly where it is, which is kind of strange. Anyway, back to you, Brian.
You would think that they could put some, like, sensor in there or something and then go outside and see where it might be coming from. But is it difficult to replace that vestibule or that part of the module with a swap out?
If you look at the Zesda module, you know, it's got a forward part and the rear part. Rear part is where the vestibule is. It's part of that module. It's probably a complete welded. You're not able to disconnect that and put a new piece in. You have an inside door, and then you have the this flared out piece that comes out after the door, and that's the vestibule. It's very short. I mean, you can't put a person in there. But all the different 15 modules that are attached throughout the station all have that space in between each one. You know, if you look at pictures of the ISS, every time you go from one module to the other, there's two hatches, you know? One on one side, one on the other. If you close it off, in between you have this vestibule. All of them are fine, except for this one. You know? So, what do you... You know, the plan is just to let it go, and they monitor it. You know, they have a pressure sensor in between, and they have to have that all the time. It's not like they added a pressure sensor. That's always been there. The reason for that is, when you first dock to the space station, let's say you have a crew coming in, or even a progress ship, you have to, equalize the pressure before you open up a hatch. You know, you can't have pressure on one side or the other. Either one or two things would happen. One would, the pressure would be so strong you wouldn't be able to open the door. This is not motorized. They actually pull on it. That's one scenario. And the other, it's the opposite effect. Can't open it up and find out it's open to vacuum. Any other comments?
I'm good. I just wanted to go ahead and find out if there was any way to put it like a tracer in there and see it leak out, or have a detector and be able to narrow it down and patch it up, or whatever.
If you look at the outside of these things, there's insulation in. You don't see metal on the outside when you're... When you're looking at some of these things, they're covered with insulation and mylar blankets protecting it from micrometeorites and stuff. There's stuff there that you can't get down to the metal to really see what you're doing. They did have a problem with the Progress vehicles years ago, and they knew they had a leak. And a couple of Russians went out there to do an EVA. By the way, when they do an EVA, they don't use our Quest system for EVA. They have their own. They're the tail end of the ISS. So, they go out that way. And I remember the one guy, you know, he got on the outside, they were trying to figure out where this leak on the Progress vehicle was, you know. And he figured, well, I'll remove some of the insulation and stuff. He was having a hard time. They show him out there. He had, like, looked like a hatchet. He's chopping away at this, like a madman. He's so frustrated. And they never did find that thing either. Russians have some issues. Absolutely. Anyway, let me go on to another topic, I guess. Good thought, you know, if it was smooth on the outside, you know you could maybe, you know, take the equivalent of a smoke bomb, you know, put it in between the vestibule, you know, have a guy do an EVA, they always go out and pass, have a couple of guys go out there, light off the smoke bomb. I like that idea. They should do that anyway, you know. Let's get a better idea of where it's really coming from. Yeah, along with you, Brian, on that one. Okay, and I've talked about the 3-eye atlas thing a couple of times. That's the comet that has come from outside of our solar system, flew through the eventually it's going to be on its way out. I think it's on its way out now. I think they're getting their last pictures of it. But what they did is they, before the thing started to leave, they ran some tests, all kinds of radio frequencies, different, you know, gigahertz, 30 gigahertz up, and another couple of different portions of the band, and they listened for any kind of what they would think would be, you know, intelligent transmissions from this thing. You know, the whole idea is to prove that this thing is really a comet and not a, you know, not an alien spaceship coming through. So, they ran all on this. They scanned it, and then they found nothing. Early on, they thought, well, maybe there is something there. And the way they eliminated that was, they have these very, very high directional antennas looking at the comet. And, in fact, one of them was the GBT, Greenbelt telescope. Yeah, a 300-foot telescope in Virginia, or is that West Virginia? I think it's West Virginia, and you know that's where the you have like 40 square miles where you can't operate any transmitters or anything because of this radio dish that's there. The radio dish is as big as a football field. It's the biggest moving thing on Earth that is controlled by people. You know, and this thing can move around. They even use that. They pointed directly at the comet, and sure they would get thought, oh, maybe it's something. So what they did is they just moved it off, slightly off of it. Sure enough, they still got the same noise. That means whatever noise they were hearing was coming from out of space. I think they eventually figured out it was coming from, you know, some of our distant satellites or something. But they've proven that it's not not an alien artifact. You know, I forgot to bring that up before this thing disappears into the Never Never Land. WS2F.
Okay, Paul. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the report. Well done, as usual. And to Roy, well done, as usual. Always consistent, always excellent. But I'm going to be going QRT because my eyes are closing. So I wish you a very good week, both of you. And I shall rejoin hopefully next week. And with that said, this is KFTZZ wishing you 73s and going QRT.
Brian, thanks for your participation and a happy new year. We got one other topic I just wanted to cover. The Spectrum rocket that should be taking off next week, 1 week from now. It's a rocket made in Germany. Not very big. It's around 100 feet tall, so like a 10-story building. About 7 feet in diameter. The idea is to put around maybe up to 2,000 pounds into orbit, which is pretty good. It would be able to be competitive against, say, the Electron rocket by Rocketman. But what's interesting is its launch location. Germany has chosen this place. It's called Andana. I think the way they pronounce it, Andana, in Norway. So you look at Norway and you go all the way up to the northern part of Norway. It is a launch complex that they bought and built. I think the European Space Agency, correction, I think the whole European Space Agency is behind the building of this thing, but they located it in Norway. And it's a beautiful location. They say it's the most beautiful launch that's been built so far. So far, only one orbital attempt from there has taken place. Last March, Germany tried to launch this Spectrum rocket from that same location. It got off the ground, I think it lasted about 15, 20 seconds, and lost power, and eventually came back down and crashed back into the ocean. So now they're going to do it again. What happened the first time is, well, it was the first launch of the Spectrum rocket, and they somehow left the vent open. And they lost pressure, and I'm sure they're going to make sure that vent is closed this time. And we'll see. Two-stage rocket. It's interesting, fuel. It's the only one that's going to be using propane, of all things. They're using a liquid propane and liquid oxygen to try to get this thing off the ground. So we'll see how it does. I'll be there. I'll be checking the website, see if they make it. And I hope they do. It's a great location for polar orbits. There's two main orbits that everybody uses. Either a polar orbit where they go over the South Pole, North Pole, over and over again, they'll use it for surveillance, taking pictures. They'll be able to get over the same location where the sun is exactly in the same position every day, and this way they're able to take high-resolution pictures. So, the orbit is a big thing, and then the other orbits that they use is equatorial. But this one is not really set up for that. And of course, that is geosynchronous orbit. Again, that this is not set up for geosynchronous orbit. Looks like it's just set up for polar orbits. Anyway, any comments before we close down? I put the clock here around 11. WS2M. Okay, I guess not. Starship is going to be making another try, rebuilding pads all over the place. Down in Florida, they plan on eventually launching these things. But they still haven't made it to orbit yet. And they're up to number 12. So I think out of 12, they've only got the equivalent of two starships actually coming down, landing vertically, perfectly. And that, again, is in the middle of the ocean, Indian Ocean. Their goal is to eventually bring it back to land and land it at one of these launch complexes where it took off from. They grab it out of the sky with these big arms. Unbelievable. Okay, this has been WS2N for the Space Night Report, and I always mention a couple of nets that the club has. And that is always tomorrow. It starts at 8:30. You have the club info net. That's always followed by Flop and Chop. George does that. And that's followed by Radio Newsline. So, we'll see. And, again, it always starts at 8:30. This net always starts at 8 o'clock. Roy, I'm going to turn it over to you. AC2GS, WS2N for the Space Night Report for the TechNet. Back to you.
Okay, Dallas, this is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. Hope you had a fun time. Hope you learned a couple of things. I hope you'll join me and all of us next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. As per usual, let me leave you with a few clever lines. One from our own Dick, K2RIW. He always ended his technical nets with the advice to be kind to each other. And I always like to throw in good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open to new ideas, but not so wide open that your brains fall out, because you're going to need them one of these days. Anyway, have a great week. Stay safe. Be well. I'm looking forward to hearing about a lot of new, interesting consumer items at the Consumer Electronics Show this coming week, and hopefully we'll be able to discuss some of them next Sunday night. So I hope 2026 has been kind to you and continues to be kind to you. This is AC2GS formally closing this episode of the Limark Technical Net. After I say, Slava Ukraini.
This is Brian, KF2ZZ. I managed to keep my eyes awake for a little bit longer. And I thank you, Paul, and I thank you, Roy. I wish you both a happy new year, and thank you for everything that you both do. But I'm going to officially QRT. KF2ZZ, saying 73. Good night.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.